KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Today is primary election day, and if you haven't yet mailed in your ballot, it has to be postmarked by 8 this evening, and you need to use a first-class stamp, or you can actually return your ballot in person at something called an accessible voting center, an AVC. Check your county election department website for more information about where those are located, and then you can tune into KUOW this evening for early returns from the this primary election in Seattle. Again, a reminder, 9 candidates vying for the top 2 spots in the mayoral race. Major League Baseball yesterday leveled its harshest penalties ever on players who've been associated with performance-enhancing drugs. 12 players, including Mariners minor league catcher Jesus Montero, were suspended for 50 games apiece. The big fish in the Major League Baseball net was New York Yankee former Mariner Alex Rodriguez. He was suspended for the remainder of this season and all of 2014, a total of 211 games. Rodriguez said yesterday that he will appeal that decision. Larry Stone joins me now. He covers Major League Baseball for the Seattle Times. Nice to have you in again, Larry.
My pleasure.
Yesterday's suspensions are related to a Florida firm called Biogenesis. What does this or what did this company do?
Well, it was quite shady, as it turned out. They called themselves an anti-aging clinic. It was supposed to revitalize. Their stated goal was to revitalize people and you know, make them stronger and healthier and younger and all that sort of thing. And it appears that it was sort of a cover for a PED outfit, performance-enhancing drugs.
So what sorts of drugs are these 12 or 13 suspended players accused of using?
Well, that's, that's a little murky. Testosterone, HGH, human growth hormones, I believe, are involved, but there's been no specified that I know of stating of what drugs they're accused of using.
Well, then, how did Major League Baseball accuse them of performance enhancing drug use?
Well, what's interesting about this case is that there was no positive test, which is usually why players are suspended. This was called a non-analytical positive. It was based on the records of the Tony Bosch, who was the founder and operator of this thing. There was a disgruntled employee who turned over records to this New Times magazine or newspaper in Miami that published an expose in January, and then eventually, Tony Bosch cooperated, and the suspensions were based on the information that he gave to Major League Baseball.
He gave Major League Baseball the names of these players.
The names and the records, the medical records, yeah.
I think the majority of the 12 players named yesterday, exclusive of Alex Rodriguez, just accepted their penalties. I know that you wrote that Jesus Montero denied that it was him, denied any connection, but I believe he did also accept his penalty. Tell me about why Alex Rodriguez gets a different penalty that's 4 times what everybody else got.
Well, I think it has to do with the fact that he was accused of interfering with the investigation, past use. He had a in 2003 he tested negative back when they were beginning drug testing. He had a very famous press conference where he admitted that in 2009, but mainly, I think it was the sort of a penalty for interfering with the investigation. That's what Major League Baseball, through sources, has said.
Now, Alex Rodriguez actually played last night.
Yeah, that's the suspension doesn't start till Thursday for him, but he is also going to appeal. And baseball's rules state that until an appeal is heard, you can keep playing, and it doesn't look like this appeal is going to be heard till the end of the season, or completed anyway. So that's what the union chief said yesterday. So it's possible that, well, with the suspension hanging over him, he can keep playing this season.
This actually was the start of his season. He had been out with a hip injury up till last night, right?
Yeah, yeah. He had a second hip surgery. He also had a quad injury that kept him out. It was pretty clear, at least it appears, that the Yankees were not that wild about having him back there. You know, it seems like they're trying to get out from his huge contract that he has remaining, $100 million or something like that, of the $250 million contract that he had. But, you know, he's claiming that he's healthy, and now he's back playing. So it's a real interesting dynamic. It's, you've got all these forces. The Yankees, you know, not even wanting, seemingly not even wanting A-Rod. A-Rod fighting this drug penalty. It's the New York Yankee soap opera to the extreme.
and maybe the A-Rod soap opera to the extreme. People, including yourself, have been ruminating on the trajectory of his career from the time that he appeared in Seattle as a rookie, kind of happy, seemingly nice. And this whole journey that he's taken, I mean, not only is he operating under the cloud of drug use accusation, but there's something more personal that it's done to who Alex Rodriguez is as a man.
Yeah, you know, he was this kind of seemingly fresh-faced, naive, nice kid when he first came up, and, you know, 94 was that long ago, almost 20 years ago, when he broke in with the Mariners. But, you know, there are people who tell you that it was phoniness all along, and I think that's the word you hear most frequently attached to Alex. He's phony. He's calculating, that sort of thing. You know, he wants everyone to like him, and in the process, it seems like everybody doesn't like him. He seems to surround himself with people who give him bad advice, there's just something about him that seems to alienate people. And there's a certain, I think, people are taking some pleasure in his downfall, and you're hard pressed to find anyone at this point who has any sympathy for Alex.
Now, if the suspension holds for him, it's all of the rest of this season and all of the 2014 season. He's 38 years old now. As you mentioned, he's had two hip surgeries. Would this suspension effectively end his baseball career?
Well, yeah, it would sure seem to be, that would be a possibility, because, you know, if the appeal isn't heard till the off season and he loses, then it would even go on. You know, those extra games that he played would have to be tacked on to
until
the 2015 season. So I would think, unless there's some sort of compromise that's reached, but. You know, 40 is the age he would be, and having not played for a couple of years, and you know, the Yankees would still owe him a lot of money, so they would probably maybe see what they could get out of him, either that or try and get out of the contract again with some sort of, this claim he violated some sort of citizenship clause or something like that. But it could get ugly, and there's a very real chance that he would not play again.
What role has and will the players' union play in this whole situation with Rodriguez and the other 12?
Well, they've already played a very significant role. There was lots of negotiations behind the scenes that led to these guys, these 12 that you mentioned, including Jesus Montero accepting the penalty without appeal. And Michael Wiener, who is the union chief, has said that if they will fight for Alex, they will support him. They believe that baseball overstepped its bounds and that there were due process issues. And so the union, they're in a precarious position because a lot of their membership actually is fed up with the drug users, the PED users, and want a lot of players sort of behind the scenes hope would like to see him get book thrown at them. And yet the union, being a union, needs to protect the rights of its players. So they're in kind of a precarious position. But Michael Weiner has said they will fight to the hilt for A-Rod.
Will this deter performance-enhancing drug use in the league itself, in Major League Baseball?
Well, I my instincts say it will, but my experience says that it won't. If the Mitchell report and all the travails of Barry Bonds and Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa were pretty much pariahs, that obviously hasn't deterred a certain segment of people who are the ones who were involved in this scandal. I'm not sure if anything will deter, everybody, but I do believe that the game is, you just have to look at the bodies. The game is much cleaner than it was in the 90s and early 2000s, but there's just going to always be an element who will try and get that edge.
Fascinating to watch the saga of Alex Rodriguez. Larry Stone covers Major League Baseball for the Seattle Times. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
Looks like it's going to be another warm, sunny day in Seattle. Currently 66 degrees, expecting to hit 87 this afternoon.
Support for KUOW comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Knight Foundation promotes informed and engaged communities and helps NPR advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org.
It's 9:18. I'm Bernard Ouellette. William Ruckelshaus is one of four Republican former heads of the Environmental Protection Agency who co-authored a New York Times op-ed called The Republican Case for Climate Action. William Ruckelshaus will join us in conversation a little over 10 minutes from now.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. Now, this next segment you might not want to listen to if you have small children around. We're talking about teenagers and pornography. Technology has changed when and how kids are exposed to sexual activity. Katie Sewell talked with Jo Langford, and she joins me now.
Yeah, hi, Marcy. Jo Langford is a father. He's a therapist, sex educator, author. He has a history of working with people with sexual behavior problems, and he also specializes in working with teenage boys and their families. He's the author of a book called The Sex Ed Cyclopedia, which gives parents an idea of what they should be talking about with their children and when. Over the years, Jo has seen how exposure to pornography has changed the behavior of teenage boys, and I asked him how their behavior has changed.
When I work with teen girls, they always tell me, they can tell the boys who learned how to do sex from pornography and the boys who didn't. When I talk to the boys about the stuff they learn in pornography, is just kind of explaining to them that it's fantasy. People don't tend to look like that in real life. People don't say those things to each other in real life. People don't do those things, certainly not in that order in real life. And kind of liken it to, explaining to them, like, you wouldn't think that you knew how to drive because you played Grand Theft Auto, would you? They understand that, but they don't understand all the time that pornography is fantasy, it's pretend.
The way that they're often viewing it because they have limited experience is this is the way that sex goes.
Oh, yeah. A lot of the problem that I've seen is them kind of being 14 and being a sexual creature, which obviously 14-year-olds are, but thinking somehow that they have, like 18-year-old sexuality or 27-year-old sexuality when they're 14. And then it gets hard for them to find a 14-year-old partner who's going to match them with that, especially if it's a girl, because 14-year-old girls aren't going to want to do that stuff.
It's almost that they're jumping over the stages of holding hands, kissing, this kind of thing, and straight to, like, I should know exactly what we're doing and everything is on the table.
Yes, and really it reminds me a lot of the kids that I work with who've been sexually abused when they were young, in terms of having a 4-year-old or a 7-year-old get a bunch of kind of adult sexuality poured onto their brain, and then they have to, sometimes all alone on their own, figure out how to navigate that and work that out. And so this is the same thing. You've got like an impressionable kid who's just in the throes of puberty and just kind of getting a sense of himself as a sexual creature and developing his sexual identity. And then they get all this information that's really intense poured onto their brain. And then they have to figure out how to sort through that mostly on their own.
What would you say, just from working in this a lot, are the biggest sexual issues that are facing our culture today?
How to be a gentleman is a big one. There's not a lot of role models for that. There's a lot more role models for for doing the sex than there are for being in a relationship. So sex without a relationship is kind of a big hurdle mm-hmm. that I think is facing young people today.
In an email you sent me, you said that on average, young boys are encountering pornography by the time they're 10 or 11 years old.
Right.
By that time, they've seen something, most likely.
Yes.
And I think you also said that by 20, everyone has seen it.
Yeah, there was a somewhat comical study that was done, I think, in 2009 at the University de Montreal. They were studying the effects of pornography on men, and so they had a group of men who had seen pornography, and they tried to get a group of men who hadn't seen pornography, and they couldn't find any. And so what they ended up finding in the study was that everyone looks at porn. The kid today who makes it through adolescence, makes it through high school, certainly, without looking at porn, that kid just that doesn't exist anymore.
Knowing that, what should parents be doing?
When I talk to parents, I try to encourage them to start the conversations with kids and always start them earlier than you think you need to. I think by the time a kid is around 7 or 8, for sure 9, to be having those conversations, like when you're online, you're going to be seeing things that are going to be shocking. Some adults like to take pictures of themselves naked, and that's a grown-up thing. If you see that, don't freak out. Come and talk to me about it. The other thing I'd like to remind parents of is that the pornography that these kids are seeing today is not the pornography that we saw when we were kids. It's not an airbrushed picture in a magazine. It's HD video, like camera angles that are really kind of scary. And the scary thing is that only statistically about 25% of kids will go and tell their parents, I saw something shaka on the internet. I don't know what this is. Please explain this to me.
Speaking with Joe Langford, who's a father, therapist, sex educator, and author, specializing in working with teen boys and their families. What myths do parents have when it comes to what teenagers are doing or what they're seeing in the pornography they're looking at?
The biggest ones, I think, are my little boy, he's not a sexual creature. He doesn't think about that kind of stuff. He doesn't want to do that kind of stuff, which may be true. Probably is not, depending on what age he is. If he's 14, if he's 17, he's definitely, you know, he's developing himself as a sexual person. There's an identity being formed there. You know, if he's younger, 10, 11, 12, maybe it hasn't happened yet. Probably I would say it has, but maybe not. The other myth, the pornography stuff, it can definitely be misused. A lot of kids use pornography as their kind of primary source of sexual education, thinking that, oh, my son's looked at porn, he's seen porn, it's going to be okay, because either, you know, his dad or his older brother or I saw porn when I was growing up and I turned out just fine. Just reminding them that porn just has a completely different meaning now. The word pornography means something different than it did even 10 years ago, really. And it's not magazines. Most kids I work with don't even bother with still pictures at all, and most of them have not ever seen a magazine.
Do you have a sense of what all this exposure to pornography is doing to young women?
I think it's self-esteem stuff in terms of what's expected from them, from boys their own age. Like I said, you know, you got a 15-year-old boy, but he's thinking 26-year-old stuff because that's what he's seen in pornography, and that's what he's going to expect or think that a 15-year-old girl wants. And then she has to be able to be strong enough in herself to say, no, what are you talking about? I'm not doing that. Or, you know, she's going to kowtow and go ahead and do it. The other thing that I notice with the girls that I work with is they've all had boys send pictures to them on their phones of their penises.
Wow.
Which is a revolting way to flirt. But again, I think that's part of that pornified culture that we're dealing with. And then the girls come to me and they say, oh yeah, these guys email me pictures of their penis, and all my friends have had that happen to them too. Like, they don't know any girls that haven't had to deal with that as well. If he showed his penis to you in a parking garage, you'd call the police. Like, why is it different? Because it's on your phone. Like,
yeah.
You don't have to put up with that. And they don't understand that's the case.
These 27-year-old expectations are becoming more normal to a 14, 15, 16-year-old.
Right, but then you have 14 or 15 or 16-year-old judgment and a camera in your pocket 24 hours a day, and bad things can happen. You know, depending on what study you look at, between 20 and 25% of teenage boys have sent someone a picture of their penis. So when I talk to parents, like, probably that wasn't your son, but maybe it was. So have that conversation with him. You know, don't send pictures of your penis over telephone lines.
Let's say worst comes to worst, something happens where as a teenager you're labeled a sex offender. Is that a stigma that you can ever get over as an adult?
It is something that they can get over. And Washington State is actually really progressive with it. I really enjoy being part of the process here in Washington. They treat kids with a lot of respect, I think. You know, boys can make mistakes. Most of the kids that I work with are really great kids who, for whatever reason, did something terrible to somebody else. Most of them didn't mean any harm. Most of them crossed lines that they didn't actually understand were there. Some of that's about social skills and some of it's about lack of education. But for a kid in Washington State who gets charged with a sexual offense and has to register as a sex offender, there's structures put in place where they can participate in therapy. And if they do a good enough job and jump through some kind of specified hoops and show that they can make some behavioral changes, they have the opportunity, one, to get their registration dismissed. And then once that's done, they can actually go and petition the court as well to get their record sealed.
And if a parent has a child that has crossed those lines, what messages should they be saying after all that has happened?
That this is not the most important thing that's ever going to happen to you. Even though for a lot of them, it's really pretty scary, the court process. And we do pretty strict forensic evaluations, like getting to know the kid, kind of getting pretty deep in the situation and figuring out what happened, what went wrong, why did this even end up on the menu of options for you to do? What do we need to do in your life and for yourself and for your family and for your community to make sure this doesn't happen again? Those kinds of questions. So it can feel really big in the moment. So just reminding them and the families, it's not always going to be like this. There's going to be a future. You're going to have a 5 years from now. You're going to have a 20 years from now, and it'll be okay. It can work out.
Thanks a lot for being here.
Thank you.
Katie Sewell spoke with Joe Langford. Joe's a father, a therapist, a sex educator, and an author with a 20-year history working with people with sexual behavior problems. He also specializes in working with teen boys and their families. I'm Marcy Silman. This is KUOW.
A conversation with William Ruckelshaus, Republican, former head of the EPA, in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Hi, this is Peter Sagal from NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. In order to keep KUOW and NPR running like clockwork, we count on support from listeners. Every minute of every day is made possible because of listeners like you. And yes, I'm talking to you, the guy on Capitol Hill with a bike. Yes, you. Everybody else, too. I'm talking to all of you. You may have recently received a renewal reminder in the mail. Please mail back your gift or renew online at kuow.org. And thanks from all of us.
Sixty-six degrees and sunny in Seattle. The sun is going to stick with us and take us up to a high of 87 this afternoon. Tomorrow, it's going to be partly sunny in the morning, then mostly sunny in the afternoon, getting up into the 80s, and it's going to be generally sunny and warm for the rest of the week. With that in mind, we'll get a recommendation for a hike to match that sunny weather in 20 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. When it comes to climate change, congressional doubters need to change their tune. That's a recommendation from four Republicans who are also former heads of the Environmental Protection Agency. In a New York Times opinion piece published last Friday, Christine Todd Whitman, William Riley, Lee Thomas, and William Ruckelshaus argue that their fellow Republicans need to stop doubting and start acting. Bill Ruckelshaus was the founding administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency. He led the EPA from 1970 to 1973, and then he returned to the job in 1983. Since then, he's worked for a number of public agencies, and he actually launched a bid himself in 1964 for public office. I guess it's to our benefit that he didn't, because most recently he's been in Washington State as the former co-chair of the Puget Sound Partnership and a director of the Madrona Venture Group. And it's delightful to have you in the studio today.
Thank you very much. Very nice to be here.
Why did you and your three fellow EPA chiefs decide that you needed to write an op-ed?
It seemed like time to do it. The president had announced his own climate change policy several weeks ago, and it was met with the usual skepticism from some of the Republicans on the Hill and others. It was met with enthusiasm by those who think we should do something about climate change. And we all had agreed for some time that the evidence that climate was changing, the Earth was warming, and that man was contributing to that phenomenon. And it was time for us to take the lead in the world and start to get serious about controlling the use of fossil fuels for most of our energy.
No, you. I mean, essentially, you told these doubters, you know, you have to stop doubting. The facts are hitting you in the face, and you need to take action. Are you specifically asking them to approve? I mean, the president's going to take an executive action, but are you asking them to follow his lead or to craft their own path?
I don't care which, as long as they do something and not continue to deny that the problem exists. The scientific consensus on this is about as broad as any issue that I've ever seen in the environment. That doesn't mean there aren't deniers or aren't skeptics about it, and that's fine. Let them be skeptics, and if they can disprove it, all the better. But in the meantime, it seems to us that we should be taking steps to alleviate the problems associated with climate change.
There is a bounty of scientific evidence that points to climate change, and it got me to wondering where the source of the doubt is. Is it strictly politically motivated?
Some of it is, without question. Some of it is generated by firms and people who have a financial stake in using fossil fuels. But there are probably some legitimate doubters. There always are on scientific theories or hypotheses like this. And as far as I'm concerned, that's the way science works. Let them question it. Let them challenge the assumptions that lie behind this. And if they can disprove it, well, fine. We don't need to worry about it. In the meantime, the evidence and the scientific consensus is so strong, it seems really unwise just to sit there and watch the Earth warm while we do nothing about it.
This op-ed got me to thinking back 40-some years to when you actually helped form the Environmental Protection Agency. And I was around at that time, but not in Washington, D.C., certainly. Was there, I mean, this was the beginning of the environmental movement when you stepped in to sort of help craft government policy. What was the attitude of both political parties at that time towards the environment?
The attitude was the public will has got to be honored. The public became aware of the problems of the environment in the 1960s. We had rivers catching on fire. We had terrible smog instances. We had public health problems of some magnitude. Very little sewage treatment was being generated in most of our cities. The public became aware, then they become concerned. Then they demanded that the government do something about it. I mean, I can tell you from having sat in the Oval Office next to President Nixon, it was not on the top of his agenda. But nevertheless, he listened to the public. And if the public comes up again and says, we've got to do something about this climate problem and take serious steps to try to reduce our reliance on carbon-based fuels for the production of energy, the Congress's response will be the same. The Clean Air Act passed in 1970, the Senate 73-1. It passed in the House 412-2. So there was complete bipartisan concern about the problem, again, generated by public demand.
We're talking with William Ruckelshaus, who has had a long career in law and working on the environment. And you talk about these bipartisan votes. These days, we look at Congress in particular, and there's not a whole lot of bipartisan action on anything, let alone the climate. It seems that you and actually the three other EPA directors who signed this op-ed with you, who wrote this with you, come out of a different movement or a different kind of politic than what we see currently in Congress.
Yeah, I think that's right. The Republican Party has gone from believing in less government than their Democratic counterparts did and other ways to try to solve our nation's problems into believing there should be no government in some cases. Now, they don't say that literally. They believe we need to defend ourselves with the national defense and things of that nature. But their belief that government almost in any of its forms is bad and that any taxes imposed on the public to support the government is bad, that it puts you in a box that is very difficult to get out of if you're trying to solve problems.
Well, when we talk about the environment specifically, since that's what we're focused on right now, and climate change, what are the literal fallouts from that antagonism and from that stalemate that happened in both in Washington, D.C., actually, and here in Olympia?
Yeah, the fallout and stalemates are that nothing happens, instigated by the Congress. What the president is saying is we'll use the current laws, particularly the Clean Air Act, and its requirements to try to control the use of carbon, both by existing power plants and by new power plants. Those are the first targets that they're looking at. But everybody agrees, including the president. He said this publicly, as did Lisa Jackson, the former EPA administrator, that it would be better if the Congress gave us a specific regime for the control of carbon so that we could do it as sensibly as possible. And they haven't done it. So the president's saying we'll use existing authorities.
And in his plan that he laid out, he talks about market-based solutions, which is something that you and your three fellow authors of the op-ed agree with. How do you see market-based solutions working when it comes to fossil fuels, for example? Are you talking about carbon emissions caps? What specifically?
That's one way of doing it, cap and trade. That was tried a couple of years ago in the Congress. It passed the House and didn't pass the Senate. It got so complicated that almost nobody understood what it was about. Far and away, the simplest way and a market-based approach is to simply impose an additional cost on the use of carbon in the form of a tax. And we tax gasoline all the time. We pay a good percentage of the price of gasoline by tax. If you want to cause people to use less of something, make it cost more. The easiest way to do that, and then let the market decide what the substitutes or other approaches might be for transporting goods, is to tax carbon, tax gasoline, among the other carbon uses.
Would you use some of the tax revenue that you recoup to fund things like solar or wind energy?
What I would do, ideally, I mean, a lot of people say if you tax carbon, then you have to redistribute the proceeds from the tax back to the people most heavily affected. And that certainly is a way of getting political support for a carbon tax. The best way to do it is to use the money from the tax to develop alternative sources, and you can use the market to do that. I mean, the world is going to develop. 88% of the energy generated in the world today comes from fossil fuels. And we can't lecture China and India and Brazil and say, don't use fossil fuels while we've used them to develop ourselves. They want to achieve the same level of prosperity that we have, and they're going to use energy to do it. Well, that's fine. But in the meantime, we should be developing alternatives for them, that alternative sources of energy that are cost effective. If they're not cost competitive with fossil fuels, they'll use fossil fuels. And China itself is determined to try to jump into the green energy possibilities in the world ahead. And as far as I'm concerned, for our own competitive self-interest, we ought to be trying to develop these alternative sources.
It seems that we've come up to the brink of working, especially on things like solar power. Different administrations propose, and then there's subsequent politicians who timidly pull back from it. It seems like a very push-pull when it comes to alternative energy development.
Yeah, it's tough. We have not had a lot of great success in developing alternatives to fossil fuels in the generation of energy by direct government research and development. Basic research and development the government probably has to do because there's so little payoff in it in any kind of time frame that makes sense for a profit-making institution. But the government can stimulate the development of alternatives. I mean, there are all kinds of ways of doing this. You can have a prize. The person that really breaks through with a cost-effective, cost-competitive energy source gets some huge kind of prize. Well, let the marketplace again try to compete for that approach as opposed to trying to let the government do it.
We're talking with Bill Ruckelshaus. He's one of four former Republican heads of the Environmental Protection Agency who co-authored a long op-ed published in Friday's edition of the New York Times calling on people to face facts, take action on climate change. As we sit and talk about perhaps adding a tax, which is the three-letter dirty word in Congress and probably on both parties' parts, developing alternative energies, we're in the midst of debates about whether we should have coal trains running through the city of Seattle and up to Bellingham. We're talking about the future of the Keystone XL pipeline, both of which are means of transport for fossil fuels. And one of the arguments that the federal government said it was not going to consider in the coal train issue was whether or not the use of coal contributed to climate change itself. Was that a bad decision on their part?
Well, as I understand it, now they've decided to spend another year studying that problem. If we had a national energy policy, which was directed at an ideal future of energy available at a reasonable cost that didn't cause all these pollution problems, and that was where we were headed, then it would be easier to fit in, whether it's a pipeline or a coal train or whatever it is, as an interim solution to this nirvana that we're seeking, and that we had believable policies to get us to this idealized future. But we don't have such a policy. People don't. So they fight it out on these individual kinds of problems, like the pipeline or the coal ports. And one argument that people use is, well, if they don't get it through our ports, they'll get it through someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what the people from Wyoming and Montana say. And if they can't get the tar sands down to the Gulf of Mexico, we'll put them somewhere else. Maybe not if we were to develop an alternative source of energy that was cost competitive with fossil fuels.
Well, that makes sense. It sounds very logical. But when we're talking about federal policy, which I believe this is probably why you and your colleagues stepped in with your op-ed, the will on both parties' parts just isn't there for whatever afraid of taxes, afraid of offending people, afraid of not being reelected to Congress if they step forward. There seems like there's a whole litany of reasons that people aren't taking the leadership role on the political level.
And it's a little simplistic to say, well, they lack political courage. But on the other hand, what will ensure that the Congress acts is if public demand takes place. If we get the same phenomenon we had in the late 60s and early 70s, public understanding, public concern, public support, and then public demand that something be done, it'll happen. Believe me, the members of Congress do listen to their constituents. And if their constituents are silent about these issues, if they say nothing and say, well, the status quo is fine with us and maybe it'll get warm, but I won't be around, so why should I care? Then nothing will happen. I mean, that's what's going on right now.
So what's the role of the media in this?
Well, the media has a wonderful educational role. I mean, far be it for me to sit in a media center and start talking about
I ask your opinion. That's why we invite you here.
I think the role is to – and I think the media has been doing this, actually, is trying to through a variety of – whether it's programs like this or television programs or other ways of highlighting the issue through education – convincing the public that they need to get involved in this. They need to demand from their elected representatives that something has to be done. We don't want to just sit here and fry over the next 200 years or let our successors, our grandchildren, suffer all
right.
The problems, but that's what we're doing.
You wrote this as Republicans, not just as former heads of the EPA. You were very specific in that party identification. What would you ideally like to see from the greater grand old party itself? What kind of action on this issue?
Well, I'd like to see, first of all, an acknowledgement that on the basis of what the scientists are now telling us, the vast bulk of scientists, we're not talking about 50-50, we're talking 98-2.
Right.
Are telling us is that this is a real problem and that man is contributing to it. And the major contribution is carbon, which comes primarily from the combustion of fossil fuels. There are other problems that are associated with greenhouse gases, but carbon is far and away the biggest contributor. And I'd like to see the party say, we agree with that. Or if not, then let's have a really serious discussion and not make a bunch of claims about there being some vast conspiracy on the basis of whom, I don't know, to keep us from using all the fossil fuels that are available. And then if they agree that there is a problem, what is your solution? I mean, don't just knock the other guys. Say, what should you do? And that's what I think is lacking so far in any platform the Republicans have embraced.
It also seems that Republicans who might agree with you, who hold office at this point, as opposed to people like yourself who have a history that you can build on, they're not just lacking in political courage, but folks who agree are deciding that it's ugly enough that they don't want to fight the fight anymore. And I'm talking about moderates who've decided, I don't want to be in the Senate anymore. This is just too messy. And they're being replaced by people who maybe are more extreme of opinion on various issues and not willing to take that kind of bipartisan action that was taken when the Clean Air Act was passed initially.
Well, there certainly is a strain within the Republican Party today that is anti-science, that the scientists will say something in perfect goodwill, and this is what their data shows them. They're following the facts. That's the conclusion they come to. And then they get attacked publicly by members of a party. I mean, their districts, congressional districts in this country, were to take a stand that we should do something about climate change, can be the death knell for the person in the next election. And that's really unprecedented in my judgment or my experience.
I was interested to read a bit about your early history in politics. You ran as a moderate for your first race. I think it was 1964. But I don't read a whole lot about environmental background for you. So when you were appointed by President Nixon to help create this environmental agency that was going to be the defining public face of environmental work, what did you actually know about it? Where were your thoughts on this developed?
You're not the only one to ask that. It was asked at the time I was appointed. I had been in the Indiana Attorney General's office,
right,
and had represented the State Board of Health, and most environmental issues at that stage were operated by states. The regulatory system was operated by states out of the State Board of Health. The environmental issues were considered health issues, and they still are. If you look at the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act, the primary standards are health standards. So I had written a very, maybe not weak, but that's close enough to being, clean air statute that was passed by the Indiana legislature in the 1960s on air pollution. And it was the best we could get at the time. And we had a program at the State Board of Health to try to control air pollution, control water pollution. I mean, these were gross smell, touch and feel kind of pollution problems. And it was even then tough to get public support for it. It was only toward the end of that decade that the whole thing exploded and the public opinion shifted and said and demanded that action be taken.
Do we need a Three Mile Island or a Cuyahoga River catching on fire to get the public incensed again? Is the scientific data about climate change too distant from us, in other words?
It's strange, you know. It's kind of like acid rain in one sense. Acid rain was a problem where the people who were generating the pollutants, primarily sulfur oxide from burning fossil fuels and power plants, they lived in an area that was remote from the area that was impacted. And so the people that were being affected living in the New England and southern, southeastern Canada were outraged. The people in the Middle West from whom the pollution was emanating were saying, oh, quit whining and go back to your knitting. Well, eventually we got that problem solved by some kind of cap and trade program. The same thing is true of climate change in one sense, is that the source of the pollution today is remote from its impact chronologically, not geographically like acid rain was. But the chronology does have something to do with it. And while everybody says they're concerned about their grandchildren, they sort of follow the advice of Groucho Marx, who was once asked, why don't you care more about posterity? He said, well, what's posterity ever done for me? That's the way people act when they're faced with this kind of problem.
What kind of reaction have you had to the opinion piece last week?
Well, I've gotten a lot of emails, some friendly, some not so friendly. As you can imagine, there's been some pieces written in the right wing publications that I've seen that are outraged about it, and the vehemence of the feeling that exists and the attack on a position like that is so emotional and so really lacking in scientific value or scientific study or fact finding that it's just not persuasive to me. I mean, I wish somebody honestly would come up and say, we've got so many fossil fuels we found today through all kinds of fracking and other efforts. If that were the answer to our energy problems, well, and it didn't cause any problem we couldn't control, fine. But that's not true. And so we need to continue to look for alternative sources and pursue them aggressively.
William Ruckelshaus, one of four former Republican heads of the Environmental Protection Agency who authored together an op-ed on climate change. It was published in last Friday's edition of the New York Times. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks a lot for having me.
This is KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. Joining us with a hike to match this week's weather forecast is Michael Fagan. Michael's with West Coast Weather LLC. His blog, Fagan's Weather World, suggests a hike that matches the weather every Tuesday. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Katie.
What do you have to suggest for us this week?
Well, you know, first, a quick bit about the weather. We're just in a real nice seam if you're liking sunny weather. We're looking at sunny weather for the entire week. At least through Friday, there's a slight chance of an afternoon shower over the weekend, but we can certainly deal with that later. So just get out during the week. We have Fremont Lookout. It's at Mount Rainier National Park on the sunrise side, and this is tremendous views. You get views as soon as you hit the parking lot. And I'd call this a kid-friendly hike in the sense that it's only 5.5 miles round trip, 800-foot gain. And you get views of Mount Rainier, and, you know, the glacier's just up front and personal. And this hike's really only snow-free, for sure, for August and September. So I'd get it in this week, especially given the tremendous views. You could probably see some wildlife. There's a herd of goats around, and if you see the goats on the trail, just give them the right-of-way. They deserve it. They're bigger than us. Bring plenty of water. We're above tree line for this entire hike, and you want to make sure you have enough water. You'll pass a frozen lake, and it might still have a little bit of snow next to it, but no snow on the trail at all. And if this hike isn't enough, you can do Skyscraper Pass or Skyscraper Peak to add to your mileage. You'll need a national park permit to get in, and this is Green Trails Map 269S. And again, this is just a tremendous hike, especially this week, the way the weather's shaping up.
Well, and I know you posted some great pictures of it at your blog, which is hikewashington.net. How hot is it going to be?
In the city, we're looking at close to 80 degrees. Up in the mountains, you know, with the sun directly on you, it's going to be pretty toasty, especially as the sun radiates off those rocks. So I wouldn't be surprised to see some temperatures close to 70, 75 in the mountains. So it'll be warm. So again, bring plenty of water. But it'll be very comfortable hiking. And that lookout, sometimes it's manned. so maybe you'll get to go inside of it. But just a tremendous view. One of my favorite hikes, that's for sure.
Sounds like quite a week. Michael Fagans with West Coast Weather LLC. His blog, Fagans Weather World, suggests a hike that matches the weather. You can read all about it at hikewashington.net. Thanks, Michael.
You bet. Talk to you next week.
This is Weekday. And now, the sound of the day. Okay, this is a mystery sound. Usually I actually know, Bernard, what the sound is, but I don't today. I'm just going to guess. I heard a ferry boat far in the distance, and maybe that's a crow?
Pterodactyl, I was thinking.
A pterodactyl. Well, our listener, Katie, sent us this sound, and she says she hears this every night outside her window from a big tree, and Katie lives in Port Townsend. Okay, so listeners, you know what this is? You hear the ferry in the background. We've identified that correctly. But is this a crow? Is it a... What is it? You tell us. Email us weekday at kuow.org and tell us what you hear. And in fact, you can email us as well and tell us what interesting sounds you're listening to. And we'd love for you to record 30 seconds of that sound like Katie did and send us the story along with the sound. Or it could be a great contest. Maybe we'll continue that. Who knows? Email your audio file to weekday at kuow.org. Include sound of the day in the subject line. For this one, if you know what the sound is, email us weekday at kuow.org and include name that sound in the subject line. I'm thinking it is a crow. Coming up, we're going to talk about Jeff Bezos and the Washington Post, and we're going to hear about whales, a lot of whale news, and then our gardening panel will be in, or two-thirds of it at least, to answer your gardening questions. So stay with us for Weekday on KUOW.
It's a minute before 10 o'clock. A military judge has reduced Army Private Bradley Manning's maximum possible sentence in the WikiLeaks case to 90 years in prison. We'll have more on that in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
A lot of people think the American sentencing system needs to be fixed, and that includes the Attorney General.
I think there are too many people in jail for too long and for not necessarily good reasons.
Democrats and Republicans in Congress agree. I'm David Greene. How unlikely allies are working to shorten prison sentences on the next morning edition from NPR News.
And you'll hear that tomorrow on KUOW's Morning News Magazine, which airs from 4 to 9 a.m.
Support for KUOW comes from the Evening MBA and ISM program at Seattle Pacific University, hosting an open house on Tuesday, August 6th from 4:30 until 6 p.m. More information and registration is available at spu.edu/business. Seattle Pacific University, engaging the culture, changing the world.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.